My wife Kate is a public interest lawyer in Philadelphia, and a few weeks ago, she and her colleagues were on a Zoom meeting, and they were doing some sort of pre-meeting chit-chat, and someone asked her intern, my wife's intern, who is a current student at Villanova University, they asked, what's Villanova's plan for getting back to class? And what he said was that the university was going to give him a chair. And she told me this after the meeting, and I said, what did he mean by that? And she said, the plan, apparently, according to her intern, was that they were going to give everyone a chair and hold classes outside wherever they could find space while social distancing, with everybody sitting in this chair that the college gives them. So I looked into Villanova's back-to-school plan, and incredibly, the school's return-to-campus plan does include giving each student a chair. There is even an Instagram account now called @PortableChairsOfVillanova with more than 200 posts, including, I'm not kidding, a meme of Oprah saying, you get a portable chair. You get a portable chair. Where the portable chair is like written in a different font. And as many questions as the chair plan raises, it's not actually the main reason Villanova's plan is unusual. A lot of universities, including a few in the region, have already said they're not even going to try to bring students back to class in person. They're going to be going all virtual this fall as far as classes go, but a lot of them are still inviting students back to campus. But why invite them back if classes won't be in person? And what does that choice say about how we view the college experience? I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. This is The Why. University of Pennsylvania education and history professor Jonathan Zimmerman has some thoughts on what's going on. John, have you been doing the last few months of the pandemic?
Well, I think like a lot of professors, I've been trying to plan for the fall. And in my own case, it's complicated. I teach both in the Graduate School of Education and the College of Arts and Sciences. The Ed School has decreed that all of its classes will be online. So the class I'm teaching there is going to be online and I'm planning as such. But in the college, even though they're bringing students back, they've said that only a fraction of the classes for the college will be face-to-face, and I don't know if mine will be part of that fraction. And I think that's pretty ubiquitous for the Philadelphia-era colleges. Almost everybody is bringing the students back, but they've declared that most of the instruction is going to be online.
Can you just describe what this fall is expected to look like?
Well, what this fall is expected to look like obviously varies from place to place, but I think in general what we're doing is we're bringing the students back to the same environments that they inhabited before, the dormitories, the gyms, the fraternities, the libraries, but we're asking them to behave in different ways, right? We're saying, wear masks and practice social distancing and wash your hands a lot. And, there are plenty of people that just don't think that's going to work. So, Larry Steinberg, who teaches at Temple, he wrote a piece recently saying, this is a pipe dream because 19 and 20-year-olds are risk takers. He thinks by their very psychological nature, and they're going to ignore all of these restrictions. And obviously, time will tell.
And what's your reaction to that? I mean, to the students being on campus, but potentially doing all of their classes remotely?
I really don't think it makes sense. Look, my wife is an infectious disease doctor here in the city, and she's been intimately involved in all of these dialogues. And there may be good public health reasons not to bring college students back to campus. There may be. But once you've decided that you're going to, at least some of them, I just don't think it's defensible not to also teach them on campus. Again, there may be places and instances where you can't do that. You know, some students don't want to be there. Some professors have certain health conditions. I'm certainly not saying that all of the instruction should be face-to-face. But given that we are bringing the students back, I do think that our goal should be to provide them with face-to-face instruction. They're going to be here.
John, obviously, we are speaking to each other remotely. I think we've all been forced to interact remotely recently. And we were talking before this interview, and I was a little surprised to learn about how old the attempts at remote instruction, particularly like college instruction, have been. Can you give me a little bit of the history there?
Yes, you know, starting in the 1930s, we introduced radio classes. And then after the Second World War, especially with the influx of students through the GI Bill, we had educational television.
This is Biology 162, General Biology. This University of Houston course examines the biology of man and his living relations with other animals and with plants.
Later, we had so-called teaching machines, which were sometimes called program learning. And eventually we had computers and the internet. And in each of these instances, the technology's goal was to widen what today would be called access. So to take the Second World War example, suddenly you have literally millions of new students flooding into the system. By 1947, half of the college students are GIs. And the universities are appropriately concerned about whether they're going to be able to teach these masses, as they were called. And so educational TV came to the fore.
Our emphasis in this particular lecture is going to be on the structure of the higher plants in particular.
The idea was use a machine to provide this education to a wider array of people. What I think is so unique about our moment since March is that everyone has had to learn via the machine. I think historically the machines have been for newcomers to the system and often for people with less privilege. So pre-COVID, who did most of the online instruction learning? It was at community colleges and it was at for-profit colleges. It wasn't at Harvard and at Penn.
Right. Can you kind of give me an example of where you think this kind of remote learning was lacking in comparison to that sort of in-person experience that we both had?
The best historical example, I think, doesn't really involve the internet or machines. It's something called the personalized system of instruction, which nobody hears about today, but in the 60s and 70s was a big time innovation in higher ed. It was designed by Fred Keller, who was a grad student friend of B.F. Skinner, the famous behavioral psychologist. And what Keller did was, he broke classes into self-paced modules, as they were called. So you do a week-long module, and then you take a test. And if you succeed at the test, you go on to the next module. And again, it was self-paced. And that's why he called it the, quote, personalized system of instruction. And I found that there were some campuses in this country where up to a quarter of the classes occurred on PSI. But the fizzle of PSI was almost as rapid as the flash because students soured on it very quickly, and they soured on it for two reasons. First of all, first generation and lower income students performed very poorly in PSI classes. It turned out if you came to college with the kind of things that PSI wanted you to do in reading and writing, you could do all right in PSI. But if you didn't come to college with those things, you washed out.
Have you taught online classes before? I know you're preparing for it this fall, but what's been your experience with it?
Well, I should tell you that my only experience has been last semester. And of course, as everybody knows, there was a very abrupt transition last semester. And so I taught face-to-face up until March, and then I taught online after that.
Was there a kind of a particular moment that you remember from that those few months at the end of the semester that was an example of where online learning you think went kind of poorly?
I think the hardest thing to communicate, the hardest thing to recapitulate in this online space is actually humor. I put a big stake in humor in my classes because I think that it can be hugely instructive. The things that make us laugh are often things that we remember and things that make us think more about why we were laughing. I couldn't figure out if people were getting the joke. You know,
right.
Sometimes I could tell that some were, but then others, you know, they're not.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Really looking at you. You know, sometimes they're, you know, looking at a book or at their phone. Maybe you get a little grin, but the laughter itself, it's so individuated, right? You don't get that kind of collective effervescence.
It's hard to read the room, right?
Exactly, from a shared joke. It's like 15 different people hearing the same joke in their own way and reacting in their own way.
We'll be right back. This is The Why. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. I'm talking with University of Pennsylvania History and Education Professor Jonathan Zimmerman about how colleges are preparing for this fall. So I want to bring it back to the current situation that colleges, where colleges are finding themselves, again, inviting students back onto campus, but not having pretty much in-person classes. What do you think is underneath that trend in particular?
Well, I think there are a bunch of things, and I think they vary based on the institution. I think for some institutions, especially kind of smaller private schools, there's obviously a fiscal crunch and imperative here. The room and board fees are very important to the bottom line of those institutions, and I think a lot of them are afraid that they won't be able to survive unless they actually collect those fees. I would say with the very elite schools, that's probably less of an issue, although it still is one. I would say the other thing that's going on with all the schools is, you know, the students want to go back. They don't want to be at mom and dad's house any more than I would have wanted to be when I was 19 years old.
Right.
And I think there's definitely a market imperative here. I think the customer, as it were, the students, they also want those services. Like, they want to be back with their peeps, back in the dorms, in the gyms, in the libraries. And my question is, if that's where they're going to be, why aren't they also in the classroom?
Has there been any pushback from professors?
There's been huge pushback there, too. You know, there was recently a survey done of professors in the 14 public colleges and universities in Pennsylvania, and about three quarters of them said they would not be comfortable teaching, in-person classes. And look, this one's hard. Everyone has different health histories, and everyone has different tolerance for risk. And I don't want any of the listeners to think that I'm saying that anyone should have to teach in person any more than they should have to study in person. But I will say this. I think there's an enormous difference between the K through 12 and higher education spaces. And I think the biggest difference is in higher ed, we teach adults. And also we as teachers have much more control because they're adults over behaviors in the classroom. So as I mentioned, you know, I'm married to an infectious disease doctor and I take my cues on public health measures from her. And she says I can teach safely in person. And the reason I can do that is that I run the show. That is, I can control the variables. So if somebody isn't masked up, I can kick them out. And let's also remember that all higher education is elective, whereas K through 12 isn't, right? K through 12 is compulsory. So in higher ed, I think we're totally within our rights to say, look, if you don't want to abide by our health rules here, you know, you're going to have to hit the road.
You know, in spite of the real positives that you're pointing out in in-person instruction, what we've been seeing in recent years, long before the pandemic, was a shift away from the sort of traditional college experience. I think primarily because of cost, because costs are really going up at a rate that is making it difficult for a lot of people to afford. But more and more students have been finding alternatives, you know, community colleges, then transfer to a university, and online courses. And now that we've had this experience of a lot of online learning, do you think this is going to sort of accelerate the move away from in-person instruction?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. University is not a total institution. That is, it's not someplace where you go and live and breathe for 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. right? It's a place that you go to get a certain kind of instruction, and then you go to the rest of your life. What we did in America is we constructed this thing called the college experience. And for a lot of people, it's been quite central to the allure of the institution. You know, this goes back to why we're bringing students back, right? Because they love college. That doesn't necessarily mean they love my class. They love being at college. They love the fact that you have all of these young people thrown together in an extremely small space. And I think that one of the big questions going forward is, what's the value of that? What is the value not just of having students in the same room, but having, say, 4,000 students in the same square mile? That's been the historic pattern, the kind of, quote, classic college experience. But let's also remember, as you alluded to earlier, that almost half of American students now are community college students. Almost none of them are residential. So this is another big question that we're going to have to ask, not just what's the value of in-person instruction, but what's the value of in-person college, period.
Well, John, it's been really good to talk to you, albeit remotely, and I wish you really good luck this fall.
Thank you, Shai. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is a professor of history and education at the University of Pennsylvania. The Why is produced by Annette John Hall, Alex Stern, Kelsey Hansen, and Sabrina Boyd Circa, with editorial direction from Katie Culinary. We had editing help on this episode from Eugene San. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. Stay safe, and we'll see you tomorrow.